I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, 23rd of January. China and South Korea this hour with Jonathan Pollack. A lot of questions for him. Is China soft on North Korea? How extensive is North Korea's economic dependence on China? Could China have any political influence in Pyongyang? What happened to North Korea's nuclear threat? And how does Dennis Rodman keep getting into North Korea? Jonathan has just returned from South Korea. He's a trooper. He's only been home for 14 hours. He's a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Program and director of the John Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution. Principal research areas include Chinese national security strategy, U.S.-China relations, Korea policies and foreign policy, and Asian international politics and nuclear weapons and international security. He's taught at Brandeis University, the Rand Graduate School of Policy Studies, UCLA, and the Naval War College. His most recent book is No Exit, North Korea, Nuclear Weapons, and International Security. Jonathan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
I think we got to talk to you about how a person rapidly recovers from jet lag. Really, 14 hours you've only been back? Aren't you exhausted?
Well, sometimes you run on nervous energy. It's kind of the way I go.
I guess it must be.
Well, I haven't collapsed yet, though.
Oh, no, so. Okay.
No, nor, for that matter, is North Korea. So there you go.
No, I guess they haven't. Well, thank you so much for fitting us in at a time when you must be pretty tired. Let's talk about, you wrote a piece in the New York Times that caught our attention. You talk about leaders in Beijing being blindsided by the latest horrific events in North Korea with the leader getting rid of his uncle and China's relationship with his uncle. How come Beijing doesn't know what's going on in North Korea?
That's a very, very good question. I don't think that they are entirely clueless, but the principal reason that China does not have a firmer grasp on the politics of the North has to do with the ability of leaders in the North to still deny China the kind of access that it would need in order to acquire that information. Now, I'm sure China has a variety of operatives, intelligence operatives and the like, who are there, but they may know much more about economic conditions in the North than they do about the decision-making at the top. It's a very closed system, to say the least, and one of the many reasons that they have been able to persist as long as they have is precisely the ability to deny any outside power a predominant role or even much of a role at all in their internal politics. Mm.
Tell us about the efforts you write about, the earliest years of China's reforms and Deng Xiaoping, Beijing seeking to coax North Korea toward gradual economic change to have some kind of normal relations. Heavens knows they have anything but that with the outside world. What have the efforts been, and have any been met with success?
Well, the efforts go back very, very much to Deng Xiaoping's earliest years after China initiated its reform and open-door policy. One of the first countries that Deng visited upon his return to power was North Korea. More to the point, Deng had a longstanding relationship with Kim Il-sung. Kim Il-sung, of course, was the founding father of the Kim dynasty. He ruled North Korea for almost a half century. And the relationship was, at that point, between Kim Il-sung and the Chinese, for the most part, not too bad. I mean, for several reasons. Number one, Kim Il-sung spent close to 20 years of his life in northeastern China, having fled Korea as a young man with his family during the time of the Japanese occupation. Mm. Kim cooperated with guerrilla units of the Chinese Communist Armed Forces when the Chinese were, of course, battling the Japanese. There were lots of interactions of that sort. So Kim Il-sung, who was very much a hail fellow, well met, had a very different relationship that he could speak with the Chinese and they could speak with them. I'm not trying to say that it was perfectly harmonious. In any event, Deng in 1982 took Kim Il-sung with him on a trip to Sichuan. Sichuan was, of course, Deng's native province. It's where a lot of the early experimentation with economic reform was underway. And Kim, who would generally travel to China about once a year, went with Deng at this point. Deng showed him some of what was going on and tried to nudge him generally in the direction of considering some change. Because, you know, it's important to bear in mind, North Korea depended profoundly on the subsidies that it received, not so much from China, but from the Soviet Union. The Russians put an enormous amount of money into North Korea over the years. And of course, when the Soviet Union ceased to exist, those benefits were no longer available to them. Mm-hmm. Indeed, if anything, the principal factor in the Soviet Union in its latter years moving towards South Korea, to quote Mikhail Gorbachev, is that we need the money, and the South Koreans were prepared to make that money available to the Russians. So in this particular case, Deng nudged Kim. He didn't want to intervene in the North's policies. More to the point, by 1982, Kim Il-sung had installed his son, Kim Jong-il, as his designated successor. So at this point, traveling in the countryside of Sichuan, Kim Il-sung made a commitment to Deng. He said, I will send my son to China once a year to listen, to learn about your reforms, although he would not have used the word reform. Reform is a bad word in North Korea because the presumption is you're dealing in a perfect system to begin with, so how could you possibly need reform? And indeed, Kim Jong-il traveled to China in June of 1983. He did not set foot in China for another 17 years.
Oh, my goodness.
I think in part because he wasn't very welcome. And if you'll forgive me going into some detail on this, it's important to bear this in mind. Deng Xiaoping had two goals with North Korea. One was to induce some degree of internal change, even as he made clear he would respect North Korea's sovereignty. The other is Deng wanted to be the arranger of some efforts at reconciliation between North Korea and the United States and North Korea and South Korea. So with Kim's approval, Deng broached with American officials, beginning first with Caspar Weinberger, American Secretary of Defense, in September of 1983, a proposal whereby China would host a three-way meeting involving the United States and the two Koreas. This was formally presented to the United States shortly thereafter. Unfortunately, the bad news is in October of 1983, North Korean agents blew up most of the South Korean cabinet. I mean that literally, narrowly missing the then president of South Korea, Chun Doo-hwan, but killed many other senior officials on a intelligence operation in Burma, where there was a large South Korean delegation then visiting. So Deng at that point thought he had lost, it had been an enormous loss of face for him.
Right.
He was angry. We are told that Kim apologized for this. But as I say, his son, who may have been in some sense trying to prove how tough he was very, very early on before he actually assumed the top position, may not have been welcome at China under those circumstances. He only began to travel to China years after Deng had died.
Mm. So if you were going to try to get more normal relations with the outside world now, North Korea and the rest of the world, are there any proposals to get North and South Korea and China and the United States at the same table?
Well, there were at a certain point what were called four-party talks in the middle of the 1990s. And then, of course, there were the so-called six-party talks hosted by China to deal with the nuclear issue.
Mm-hmm.
These first began in, I believe, 2003, and they continued episodically over that period. They have not met since December of 2008. And this was China's effort, I think, in part, to make an initiative in international diplomacy, to serve as the host of these meetings, on the belief that you could coax the North somehow into foregoing or at least over time yielding some of its emergent nuclear weapons potential. Those talks periodically, China will make reference to them again, the belief being that there were agreements, in principle agreements, signed by all the parties based on a Chinese document that all agreed to in September 2005 that in theory, and I emphasize in theory, would have provided in a more long-run sense a way to, you know, normalize relations across the region. But remember, part of the problem here, if you will, from a North Korean perspective, is there are two Koreas. One of them works. The other doesn't. Mm-hmm. It's not widely recognized today, this being an era where most Americans, when they look at South Korea, they think of Samsung, they think of Hyundai, you know, world-class automobiles, fancy watches, fancy high-end smartphones and so forth. But South Korea historically was very underdeveloped. It was the North that was the dominant economic force on the peninsula. When Park Chung-hee, who seized power as a general in South Korea in 1961. His daughter, of course, is now the current president of South Korea. South Korea's gross domestic product was less than $100 per capita. Hmm. South Korea, of course, today is probably the 12th or 13th biggest economy in the world. It was not until the mid-1970s that the South exceeded the North in terms of per capita GDP. And today it exceeds the North's per capita GDP, probably by about 30 times. So you have to look at those power dynamics as well. So you have a situation where by any objective measure, the only success that North Korea can point to is that it has persisted in power. It has grimly persisted under extraordinary international isolation, at times grievous failings in their own food production. There was a major famine, for example, in North Korea, only years after the Soviet Union ceased its aid to the North because the Soviet Union itself was going out of business. So North Korea, in that sense, has always been able to find ways to, if you will, squeeze the international system, either allies or former allies, at times when South Korea has been more generous under previous presidents, or even significant aid that the United States provided North Korea in the aftermath of the agreement on the freezing of North Korea's nuclear weapons program under the agreed framework negotiated between the United States and North Korea that took place in 1994. So I mention this only to say that it is not as if there have not been efforts to move towards some larger relationship among all the powers. But at the end of the day, I think North Korea, with the exception being under presidents in South Korea who throw them a lot of money, and there have been several instances of this, North Korea recognizes that the biggest threat to their viability and existence long term is the extraordinary success of their fellow Koreans to the south. Let's remember, South Korea was a military dictatorship for many years. It is an open, thriving, if somewhat contentious, democracy today. And as I said, it is at the forefront of globalization. It's the most wired country on earth. So you have this jarring contradiction between the two Koreas. What the North can say is they have nuclear weapons. Mm.
So is that the reason then, the underlying reason that we see these nuclear threats? We haven't seen them for a few months now, but it seems like periodically we get these major announcements, these major threats. It's all over our news, and then they kind of disappear.
Well, that's North Korean politics. That's North Korean propaganda. It's political theater. They're rather good at it,
yes,
in
they
one
are.
Sense. But it's very dangerous political theater. So you're absolutely right. It was less than a year ago that North Korea was threatening repeatedly to attack the South. They even threatened to incinerate Washington, D.C., even though they do not have the means to reach Washington, D.C. But it's more the style with which they conduct their politics. But the very fact that it's not really meaningful in any sense. I mean, it's done for the purposes of reinforcing domestically in North Korea that other outside powers threaten their existence. And of course, the finger is pointed first and foremost at the United States, because the United States maintains close to 30,000 U.S. forces on the peninsula. It is a close ally of the North. And very frankly, this frustrates the North. Mm-hmm. It makes us, in their measure, the villain of the piece, even though I would argue in some sense they need a villain. They need a villain to justify the conditions under which most of their citizens live. The implication being, if it were not for the evil Americans, we would be a prosperous place. So let's make sure that we have the means to defend ourselves, even having these weapons that so few states in the world have, and even though North Korea is, for the most part, a desperately poor society.
So what role does China play in helping out North Korea in one way or another, through trade, through any kind of assistance? Is that important?
It is important. For some years, China really was not very forthcoming with the North. But these policies shifted beginning about 5 years ago. When in the aftermath of Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un's father, having had a severe stroke, the Chinese, in effect, decided to double down on North Korea. The prime minister of China at the time, Wang Jiabao, made a trip in the fall of 2009. So this was only a few months after North Korea had tested a nuclear weapon for the second time. And he came with all of the economic advisors and heads of ministries, raising possibilities of Chinese investment in the North, use of a North Korean port facility, steps towards various kinds of special zones and the like. I mean, the kinds of things that, frankly, the recently departed Jang Suk-taek subsequently negotiated. So the question is, why was Wang Jiabao undertaking these steps? There seemed to be a consensus within the leadership, and there was, because that's the only way the Chinese make these kinds of decisions. They do it by consensus. And my surmise is that the Chinese believed that with Kim Jong-il's stroke and likely imminent passing, and he died in 2011, the Chinese would have an opportunity one more time to test the possibility of encouraging a measure of economic change in the North, encouraging a somewhat more open attitude towards the outside world. Because again, North Korea, although it maintains a number of embassies in the North, not boundless numbers, but they're there. There's including some representation from Europe, but otherwise, it depends disproportionately on China for its trade links to the outside world. China provides North Korea food. It provides it energy assistance in terms of oil. It provides a lot of consumer goods to the North. That includes a variety of luxury goods that get into the North that then Kim Jong-un makes available to the leaders at the top or near the top to maintain their loyalty. So absent that kind of an economic role, commercial role, North Korea would be in vastly more desperate circumstances, even than the ones that it presently encounters. So China, at this point, probably does about 70% to 80% of trade and transactions with the North. It's really quite remarkable because at this point, the South has restricted its activities with the North. Japan's trade with the North, which used to be quite significant, Japan, even into the 1990s, was North Korea's second or third biggest trading partner. That's absolutely closed down. The U.S. does virtually, I mean, to say that it's infinitesimal is an understatement. Tiny, tiny bit of commercial transactions. Russia, I mean, again, the Russians in theory would like to be back in. Because in theory, North Korea could be a very productive society. It's got lots of minerals, other kinds of natural resources. It's got water access. There are all kinds of things that it could do if it was prepared to do them. But the very fact that the Russians remember that North Korea reneged on repayment of all of its debts and that ultimately the Russians gave up even trying to collect on any of them. And these were debts in excess of $10 billion. Just illustrates the point. It wouldn't be a good investment for the Russians. If conditions were changing in the North, if the North was more open and accessible, if North Korea was willing to deal more fully with its neighbors in the South, Russian calculations would change, particularly in terms of energy transactions and so forth. But that's not what we see. So as a consequence, China, which shares a common border with North Korea, where there are ethnic Korean minorities along that border, becomes the primary point of interaction in terms of trade, the transactions both near the border, use of Chinese port facilities to, in a minimal way, connect North Korea to the outside world. Without China, they would be quite literally devoid of options.
We will welcome phone calls. Obviously, a follow-up question would be, and we'll get to that, because of that kind of trade, does it put China in a place where they could exert pressure on North Korea to make some meaningful changes, like don't kill your uncle and open yourself up to the outside world in some ways? We'll ask Jonathan that in just a moment. Here's how you reach our conversation. Jonathan Pollack is our guest. He has just returned from South Korea. He has been to North Korea a couple times and wrote a piece in the New York Times, "Why Does China Coddle North Korea?" January 12, it was in the Times, and that's posted on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show, where you can leave messages. You can also call 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Jonathan Pollack, and we start with Steve in Madison. Hello, Steve.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Hi.
I'll give you an elephant in the room, only slightly off topic. Reunification. Why do I have the impression that the United States and other powers that be never allow the option of reunification to ever appear on any geopolitical agenda, especially as the North Koreans and South Koreans are much more culturally alike than are the United States, much more homogenous than are many of the Middle Eastern countries? Why isn't reunification ever allowed to approach the level of realpolitik?
Steve, that's a good question. In fact, both South and North periodically or sometimes quite frequently talk about unification, and the United States, for its part, has repeatedly emphasized it is not opposed to a peaceful, democratic unification of the peninsula. Koreans are well aware. I mean, again, as was just mentioned, I returned last night from South Korea. And in the discussions there, I was reminded yet again that Korea, for all intents and purposes, is the only last divided country in the world. The Koreans see themselves, understandably, as a victim of the aftermath of the end of the Pacific War and the onset of the Cold War. And there's more than passing truth to that, even as attitudes about unification, certainly in the South, have changed significantly. A lot of South Koreans, particularly younger South Koreans, know little about the North, care little about the North, and probably would be concerned about what the extraordinary disruption and cost would be if and when unification were to occur. So all of this said, the United States obviously retains a very close relationship with the South. It's interesting, by the way, that in the mid-1990s, in the aftermath of the agreed framework accord, that at that point, part of what was to agree to was that the United States would open a liaison office in Pyongyang. We even had the property selected. I know quite well the individual who's to be the first head of the liaison office. The North, for its own reasons, and I think I know what they are, said no deal. We won't proceed ahead with that. So that's what stymies this more than anything else. I mean, unification, if it is to occur in some kind of gradual, peaceful accommodation, cannot happen as long as you have a regime in the North that denies the fundamental legitimacy of their neighbor to the South. At the same time, I think that the South has a very, very mixed impression of the North, to say the least, that in the South, you know, as I've mentioned already, that it's an extraordinarily prosperous place. So the South looks at the North as their poor cousins, if you will, still trapped in a mindset of the Korean War, still convinced that unification should occur, and it should be on the basis of a North-led unification, not a South-led unification. So that's, you know, that's what to many of us seems so laughable. You know, having said that, even among the communist states, I mean, I mentioned before the Soviet Union and then subsequently China recognized South Korea. China has an enormous relationship with South Korea today. South Korea today does more trade with China than it does with Japan and the United States combined. Soon, South Korea will be the leading that China will do more exports to South Korea than it will do with Japan. So the Chinese haven't sat with their hands folded. They figure they understand. There are two Koreas. One of them works. The other doesn't. Yeah. So at this point, China has two-way trade with the North of about $6 billion a year, which is far higher than it was even 4 or 5 years ago. And trade with the North, with the South and China exceeds $250 billion a year, and it is headed, the target for 2015 is $300 billion. So I don't want to say it's all just trade, but, you know, the Chinese have their own interests. They're heavily economic and transitional. They want to become more powerful, more prosperous. So if you're looking at the Korean Peninsula, you ask, okay, well, where can we do business? The Chinese know the answer.
It's hard for me to imagine any possibility of talks about reunification if you have a regime in North Korea that's holding on to power to the extent that they are, and there's very little access with the outside world. How in the world are you going to get them to talk about reunification?
That's a fair question. I should say that, and this is what makes it such a quirky but fascinating place and history of the peninsula, that there have been times where the North and the South have talked, even at a point when South Korea was run by Park Chung-hee, who was, you know, an extremely authoritarian leader. Those have often been triggered more by perceptions that the great powers were trying to manipulate you. So it's no accident that these talks between North and South that were transpiring in the early 1970s came in the immediate aftermath of the U.S. negotiations with Beijing and U.S. efforts to, of course, improve relations with Moscow as well. And so it was under those circumstances that the two Koreas both separately felt vulnerable. And on that basis, they talked. I must tell you that all the diplomatic archives from that period have been totally declassified. They are extraordinary documents.
Oh, I imagine.
In terms of Koreans, North and South, like Steve, your questioner, noted, they are it's an ethnically homogeneous population. But it's two systems that have led such different lives that their entire essence – the way they've approached their politics, the choices that they have made are fundamentally different. And how that is to be overcome is just a question none of us have an answer to, except to say, if you look at the North, can they go on this way? Can they continue to defy the laws of gravity, economic and political? I will have to say that there have been repeated predictions that the North was on the edge of collapse. When I last checked, they're still standing.
Right.
It tells us something about the extraordinary resilience of this regime. I'm fond of observing that a professional colleague of mine has written a book about the North, which he calls The Impossible State. And I have told him that's the wrong book title. It's not The Impossible State. It's The Implausible State. It has a nearly 70-year history. You have an effect. In effect, it's a very traditional Korean dynasty. And, you know, the best way to keep your enemies at bay is to centralize power, put up with, tolerate independent opinions, and expect absolute deference to the throne. So now you have Kim Jong-un, the third in the Korean, the Kim Il-sung dynasty. I like to call young Mr. Kim 3.0. That's my nickname for him. He reminds me a lot of his grandfather. And a lot of people assumed, how could this young kid take over in power? Pointing out that when his grandfather took over, before there really was a state yet, he was also a young man. And when his father was chosen to succeed his father, he was also selected as a young man. So there are things that go on here. But fundamentally, this is a threat-based system. It's a system that cannot abide the success of its neighbor to the south.
Mm-hmm.
And unless we can find a way to break through that, you're kind of stuck with a very divided peninsula unless and until the North can no longer sustain itself.
Thank you, Steve, for your call. Scott in La Crosse, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for yet another fascinating program. And I'm very glad you brought up dynasty because that leads into exactly what I wanted to ask. Earlier this month, PBS program Frontline did a documentary inside North Korea. And first of all, well, I'd like to know what you thought of that. But if I'm remembering correctly, they either stated outright or implied that there is a lot of hostility in the ranks of the North Korean military over the coming of Kim Jong Un, and that they resent that they don't think he was ready, and they resent his taking, you know, the power being handed to him. And I guess my question about that is, given the nature of this country since the Second World War, what did they expect? I mean, were they thinking that the power could be passed to them, or that some other system would evolve? I mean, for me, watching from the way on the outside, I just assume this is the way the dynasty works. You know, the next in line gets handed the power.
Right. Well, ironically, Kim Jong-un has two siblings, a half-brother and a full brother, okay? In theory, because he's the young one, power should have passed to one of his siblings. But the oldest, a man named Kim Jong-nam, different mother, he has lived outside of North Korea now for decades. He spends a lot of his time in Macau. He also has a home supposedly near Beijing. Latest reports have him spending a lot of time in Singapore. And ironically, he seems, from interviews we've seen of him, a fairly modern man. Speaks multiple languages. He's said some things that are very, very critical of dynastic succession, though perhaps at some level that's resentment on his part, because in theory, if it was a true dynastic succession, the job would have gone to him. But the point being that Kim Jong-un was seen by his father as the one best suited to succeed him as I'll call him emperor. It's kind of laughable. Here he is. He's about 30 years old. They've already made him a marshal in the North Korean army. Kim Jong-un bears an uncanny resemblance to his grandfather. He's got all of his physicality. He's extroverted, like his grandfather was, whereas his father was not at all. So as to whether and in what form there is resentment of him, particularly in the military, that's understandably speculative, maybe some scattered evidence of it. It's very, very interesting. When Kim Il-sung, when Kim Jong-il died, there was his body was in a hearse, ironically enough, an old Lincoln Continental, that on a snowy day in Pyongyang, surrounded by, if you will, eight pallbearers around the hearse, four of whom were military officers. None of them are any longer in power. The only two other than Kim and the other three were Kim Jong-un. Obviously, he's still very much in power. But the other three, Jang Suk-taek, now executed, and then two very elderly figures from the party, both well into their 80s and clearly no threat to Kim Jong-un. So Kim Jong-un has not only succeeded to the throne, he has managed to displace many of those who were loyal to his father. So is there resentment about being displaced? Hard to know. I mean, ironically enough, Kim Jong-un has tried to rebuild the party and the government apparatus, which means in some sense some of the power has been taken away from the North Korean military. I did see the frontline program. Just given how incredibly difficult it is to get any kind of information coming out of the North, there was some really very powerful footage in that show. I don't want to say it was misleading in some sense. I mean, for example, I doubt seriously that any of the illicit footage there was filmed in Pyongyang. My guess is it was probably filmed in some of the locations that are very contiguous to the Chinese border along the northeast, because they would be the easiest to get to, in effect. They showed some, you know, wretched scenes because, again, in a lot of ways, there are two North Koreas. There's Pyongyang, where all the money flows, and then there's everything else, and where people are left to fend for themselves, and where in the aftermath of the Soviets cutting off the spigot for aid, a lot of North Koreans were forced to fend for themselves. So there's kind of an informal market of one sort or another. But that was also the time of famine and also the time of just incredible industrial decline in the North. They've made a limited recovery from that. But, you know, fundamentally what drives their policy is acute militarization of the state. So even if the North Korean military, some of them might resent young Mr. Kim, they are also huge beneficiaries of the decisions that have been made.
Thank you, Scott, so much for the call. Let's talk just a little bit more about Jang Suk-taek, who was done away with. You in your piece talked about his being China's primary channel to the North, not Beijing's man, but had far more extensive international experience than any other leader in Pyongyang. That's fairly significant, isn't it?
Oh, sure. He had been a figure, you know, he came up through the party apparatus. He married above him. That is to say, he married Kim Jong-il's one sister. According to some historical accounts, Kim Il-sung did not approve of the marriage, but it may have, you know, his resistance may have ultimately been overcome. So he got into the royal family by marriage, all right? But if we look at his history over the last several decades, we know that he had traveled to Russia, to Western Europe, repeatedly to China, and once to South Korea in, I think, about 2004 or 5, if I recall correctly. Now, none of this makes him a thoroughly modern man. But if you're talking about somebody who has been exposed in some sense to the outside world, mm-hmm. has some knowledge of the outside world, Jiang fit that profile. I'm not trying to put the guy on a pedestal. Some are suggesting that, well, he was the one who really would have undertaken great reform in the North. Who knows? I mean, the best evidence suggests that his ability to control different projects, economic projects in the North, and for he and those around him to garner significant resources may have been the ultimate source of his undoing. By the way, one of the accusations against him was that he was selling North Korea's resources cheaply. And, of course, they were being sold to China.
Hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Jonathan Pollack is our guest this hour. We're talking about China and North Korea and South Korea. He wrote a piece that caught our attention January 12 in the New York Times. Why does China coddle North Korea? It's on our Facebook page if you would like to read that. He has just returned from South Korea. He's a senior fellow in the foreign policy program and director of the John Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution. His most recent book, he's written many of them, is No Exit, North Korea, Nuclear Weapons, and International Security. 800-486-8655 is our number. We'll return to you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Let's go to John in Richland Center next. Hi, John.
Hello. First, I'd like to compliment your knowledgeable guest for all the valuable information we're getting, because we don't get much information out of North Korea at all. And secondly, I read the book on the Korean War twice, and there was so much bloodshed. China was sending like teenagers into that war, and it was China in North Korea against the Americans. And I can't understand the difference between a tyrannical dictatorship or a dynasty as far as the power structure goes. And then I am asking about that industrial park. Is North Korea trying to get some more revenue from the South Korea's success?
John, you've asked a lot of questions. I'll see what I can do to answer them. The Korean War was indeed an incredibly bloody conflict. It may even be one of the reasons why, even to this day, China does not fully let go of that past history. China was not initially involved in the war. The war was kind of grudgingly approved by Mao, but more important, grudgingly approved by Stalin. He's the one who made it possible when North Korea invaded the South, crossed the 38th parallel. China intervened only subsequently when MacArthur's forces were moving very far north on the peninsula, and the Chinese warned the United States of the implications of that. So I'm not saying that the Chinese were eager to get involved. They lost a lot of men in Korea. North Korea as a society was flattened. The amount of bombing campaigns, I mean, this kind of stuff, regardless of how we may feel about the North, that is deep in the psyche of leaders and even, you know, a lot of the people who, of course, have been, you know, fed a lot of information about North U.S. being North Korea's eternal enemy. So you have that history. But as one Chinese official once said to me when I queried him about some of the things that North Korea was doing compared to the alliance relationship that China and North Korea had once had, he said to me, then is then, now is now. The Chinese have a very, very different definition of their interests, as I indicated before with some of the questioners. You know, having said that, there's still elements when we look at how North Korea operates, where it can cleverly and resourcefully make gestures or find ways to acquire resources when it sees it in its interest. I mean, it's a needy state. So when Kim Dae-jung, the first South Korean president to travel to North Korea. He did this in 2000. when he went to meet with Kim Jong-il, we knew only in retrospect how much he had paid for that visit. And the answer is $500 million.
Oh, my goodness.
Which he subsequently acknowledged. So you have that. But let me. But you raise the issue of the zone, the Kaesong zone. Kaesong is a city just across in the border, across the border from the south. And about a half dozen years ago, South Korea initiated a special zone there where basically South Korean firms employ North Korean workers. Right now, there are about 50,000 workers there. They're probably paid a little better than a typical North Korean worker might be paid, but the state obviously benefits from this. On the other hand, the South has always calculated that, well, you know, in some sense, this is a small foot in the door. I mean, if only because, you know, South Korean workers work in very modern facilities. They can see what advanced technologies or advanced manufacturing techniques are like. Ironically, just to give you an example of how strange the place is, South Korea manufactures something called a choco pie. I've eaten a few of them. It's a very tasteless dessert. Some compare it to like a Hostess Twinkies. I think a Twinkie is much better. Be that as it may, part of what the companies who provide for the workers in these facilities have done is they've given them choco pies. And it's my understanding that in most cases the workers don't eat them, they sell them.
Oh.
They become a currency, a means of transaction on the open market. It's something sweet.
Huh.
It's something that people can enjoy. You know, understand that in the North today, the dominant currency is probably not the North Korean won. It's the Chinese yuan, the Chinese currency, because it has more value. Dollars have more value, but just there aren't as many of them. And euros have more value, but there aren't as many of them either. So, you know, under these circumstances, people adapt and do things that are in some ways really quite creative if you think about it, whether it's induced by the regime or whether it's induced by the efforts of individual citizens.
Thank you, John, for the call. We only have a little over a minute left, but I have to ask about when our listeners say we don't get much information. We sure get a heck of a lot of information about Dennis Rodman, who has, you know, at least he's in rehab. He won't be there again. But how does he keep getting into that country, and why do we make such a big deal out of it?
Well, I'll try to explain this quickly.
All right.
Madeleine Albright, when she was Secretary of State, visited North Korea at the very, very end of the Clinton administration.
Uh-huh.
And we knew that some of the people in the North were big basketball fans, including the leadership. So when she met with Kim Jong-il, she presented him a gift, because always the idea when you meet with a North Korean leader, you bring a gift.
Yeah.
She brought an autographed basketball, autographed by Michael Jordan.
Huh.
So when there were some visitors to the North, kind of clever guys, marketeers, whatever, they figured, oh, let's get Michael Jordan to go to North Korea. Jordan refused. They got Dennis Rodman. Dennis Rodman is a man not only who's obviously very imbalanced, he's hugely in debt. So he was only too willing to go and to break bread with his best pal, Kim Jong-un. So I think Rodman has been there four times this year. But again, in a funny kind of way, it's what a North Korean leader says validates him, because here is this ex-NBA star. So this shows that North Korea matters, that the Americans treat us as an equal. Remember, they could care less about how this plays externally. What they do care about is how it plays internally.
Yeah. Jonathan, thank you so much. I hope you get a nap this afternoon. You've just been a wealth of information. And we really...
My next meeting is at 3 o'clock.
Oh, no. All right. Carry on. Thank you so much for being
with us.
Not
at all. I've enjoyed it a lot.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jonathan Pollack, our guest, senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Program and director of the John Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution. His most recent book is No Exit, North Korea, Nuclear Weapons, and International Security. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing this program and to KP Whaley for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we will talk more about healthcare costs in the USA.